Welcome to the Journey to the New Earth podcast, where we invite you into our motivating and fun community to safely share ideas on raising consciousness and creating new systems that support humanity and Earth as a whole. We'll dive deep with fascinating interviews about near-death experiences, the world of psychics, mediums, and how channeling affects our modern lives, all while exploring where we are, what isn't working, and what we can do to facilitate the evolution of humans on a local, global, and galactic scale. Now here's your host, Kimberly.
Today we're talking with Peter Panagori, near-death experiencer and author. Welcome in, Peter. How are you today?
Hi, Kimberly. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, I was just saying off camera before we started, I've been following Peter's story for a long time now. I actually even watch your YouTube channel from time to time. I feel like we're friends. We just haven't met yet. But it might be new to some of the viewers today. It's such a powerful story that I'm excited to hear it again. So why don't you take us back to what was going on in your life before you had your near-death experience?
Well, this was back in 1980 that I had it. My first one. I was in Montana escaping my family turmoil, as young people sometimes do. I had a sister who had run away when I was 14 and she was 18. I know that sounds like she was responsible, but she was not. And it broke my family up. And so I left, basically. So I was out west at Montana State University on an exchange program. And I wanted to stay away from Boston during spring break. So I went on an adventure, and my adventure was to go snow caving and ice climbing in British Columbia and Alberta, Canada in March.
It's such a dude thing to do.
Totally. But I was also, I had been a Boy Scout and until I was like 18, I was an Explorer Scout even. And I'd on the National Ski Patrol. And so I was an outdoor kind of winter guy, but And the snow caving aspect of it, it was most of the time that we were there. We snow caved, we backcountry skied way far into the wilderness, into British Columbia. And we had a great experience, learned a lot about each other. My new friend, Tim, who had just finished his ice climbing certification, and he wanted to do this ice climb. And so we went into Alberta, north of Banff, to do this climb. And I talked Tim into allowing me to climb against the rules, and the rules included having two ice axes. But because I so much wanted to do this and he so much wanted to do this, he agreed. I climbed with an axe and a hammer, which is a very big difference. The axe is much longer. You can swing it, has a longer swing to it, and you can let go of it and relax. There's a strap that can support you, but the hammer is much shorter and you can't ever let go of it. And it was a three-pitch climb. So my climb was significantly slower than all the other teams on the ice that day by probably twice as much. And I became exhausted as a result of having to hang onto the hammer. And every advance up the ice was shorter than it should have been. That's the setup for me. So by the time sunset was coming, Tim and I both knew that we were in serious trouble, that we were probably going to be stuck on the mountain after dark, which we were. And when the sun set, the temperature dropped about 30 degrees, and we didn't have extra food with us or extra water or any sort of warming device because nobody did on the climb. It was a day climb. The intent was just to be up and down. This temperature dropped. Hypothermia began immediately. I ended up with violent shivers, which I experienced as felt like every individual muscle in my body was pulsating at a different rhythm than every other one. And so the whole thing, I was this big rattly, jangly, jaw clattering mess. And we knew that we were in serious trouble. We knew that this was probably going to kill us. And that was a realization that was building in us as we were nearing the top of the climb. And when the dark set down, ba-boom, hypothermia began, it became an immediate reality of terror. So the first thing that we did was not panic, because if we panicked, we were definitely going to die. And we talked about snuggling up together, cuddling, canoodling up against the mountain together to conserve our body heat, but we didn't have any body heat. The only body heat that we had, because we were thinly dressed for the daytime, not overly dressed for the nighttime. So, and the thinly dressed that we were for the daytime included physical exertion. So we were exerting ourselves, and that kept us warm with the clothing level that we had on. And now we're sitting there not moving and the temperature is much colder. So we decided that the only chance we had for survival was to try to get down in the dark on the ice. And which meant traversing and descending and traversing and descending and three descents. It was harrowing. I kept my fear in check because fear was going to kill me. But I took a lot of my mental strength to do that. Every step I took forward through the night drained my energy level. It got colder every minute through the night. And so I was running out of energy. So I was utilizing my energy to stay warm, but my battery was running low and my environment was getting colder all night long. And so we had this continual fight against the elements and ourselves throughout the night. I can tell you the whole high adventure. We got stuck. We made mistakes. Hypothermia stole our reason. It's what happens. The brain begins to freeze. Lips freeze. It makes it difficult to talk. Coordination. We lost our coordination. I got frostbite. I have all my digits. I had second degree, not third degree. I had blisters, but no black damage, no death to my hands or my feet. I still suffer from it, hence the gloves. We made it all the way to almost the last rappel, where I had this experience where my willpower to drive myself forward, control with might of mind, became instinctual. There was this, like some part of my brain opened up that was more animalistic, much more original hominin way back when, that survival became not a driving factor of my thought process. It became a driving factor of my being itself. And I'm not sure how to explain this survival thing. But when we get to the last rappel, now it's sometime before dawn. We've been fighting our way through the night. Hypothermia kept advancing. We were clipped into the mountain for the first time, which means that there were iron pins in the mountain, epoxied with rings and carabiners and straps. And I was hooked in. Tim was to my left. And Tim was a new guy to me. I should say this too. We met through the outing club because he had this trip plan. And so we went on this little backpacking trip before in the winter. I think it was in October that we went, which is where we met. And then we decided to go on this trip in the springtime. Is that right? No, we met in January, and we did a little winter camping trip in February. There's a very small thing we did in order to see whether we were compatible or not. And so Tim was a new guide in my life. I trusted him with my life. The whole week before, when we were out wilderness camping, we encountered all sorts of trials and tribulations that we learned that both of us had skills that would help us survive. So I trusted him literally with my life. But he was to my left and I was to his right, and we're on this ledge and we're clipped into the mountain so we don't fall. But hypothermia has continued to advance. It was getting colder all night, and I had the rope, and we were maybe 100-150 feet up. Last rappel, I took the rope and I tied one end, had to take my gloves off, which is advanced. Every time I took my gloves off, my hands got worse. So I had to take my gloves off to tie the rope and put my gloves back on. I took the other end of the rope and I tossed it out around the side of this crag, this corner, and I yanked on it once. And as soon as I pulled on it, it jammed somewhere up above me. And I pulled it again and it got tighter and tighter and tighter. And now we had no rope. We couldn't go down. We couldn't go up because I couldn't ascend this descent that had just come down. It was in the dark, for one thing. The moon had risen, but it was in a shadow and it was off the ice. It was a rock. I had crampons on and I couldn't feel my hands or my feet. So we were in the situation where we knew that we were going to die where we were. And I had this heat gather into me, as happens to hypothermic people. And I unzipped my coat because I felt hot. I felt like all my blood had rushed to my core. And so I unzipped my coat. And a lot of people who die from hypothermia, a number of people who die from hypothermia are found naked. And that's what was happening to me. And Tim yelled at me. This is like the first words he'd said to me all night. Don't unzip, zip your coat back up, for hours. And because we weren't talking, because every time we spoke, our batteries would go down. We were very, 5% left kind of thing. And I didn't care. I knew better intellectually that was a mistake because I'd been on a ski patrol and I knew about hypothermia, but I didn't care. And as this happened and I unzipped my coat and I felt my body cool down, this peace came over me because I recognized that I was going to die there. And so my drive went away for survival. It just shut off like the flick of a switch. And in its place, I had peace. And the terror that was underneath it, that was gone too. I accepted my circumstance and I started thinking about God and I started thinking about my family. And I knew that there was nothing I could do about it. You know, my mom and dad were going to lose another kid. It was going to be international news because we were in Canada and we're from the United States. It's going to be in the Massachusetts newspapers and it's going to be terrible for my parents. And there was nothing I could do. And then I began to fall asleep. And when I would fall asleep, I'd collapse to the rock, smack my helmeted head, wake back up, stand up, pull on the rope, because I was still trying to survive. And then I stood up this one time. And as I stood, my peripheral vision became this big black circle. So I had light in the middle and big black circle around it. And I didn't understand what it was. And it began to collapse very rapidly. And all this out here is black. And this is my vision got smaller and smaller. And I was thinking to myself, I must be falling asleep, but this is so weird. I'd never seen such a thing before. And every time I'd fallen asleep this evening, that night that I was dying, it was like a curtain drop, kaboom. And I was unconscious. There was no drifting, lulling off to sleep. It was instantaneous. But this time, it was taking this enormous amount of time. And then as it closed down to nothing, I thought, oh, I'm going to lose consciousness. And then I didn't lose consciousness when it went all black. Just the opposite happened. I awoke. So ba-boom. And now I'm awake and I'm confused because I don't know what's going on. All of my pain was gone. I know my hands don't hurt, my feet don't hurt, nothing hurts. I don't understand where I am. And where the mountain had been was now this deep velvet darkness that extended, well, at a great distance. And this weird thing is that I could see the darkness extend, even though it was completely dark. And I knew that something was going on, but I didn't know what. And as I was staring out, trying to figure out where the mountain had been, am I standing up? Did I fall down? What's going on? A pinprick of light appeared in the very far distance. And this pinprick of light rushed toward me faster than the speed of light. And as it rushed toward me faster than the speed of light, it filled this darkness. And it communicated to me telepathically, but no language. There were no words. It was information that was direct. And the information it directly sent to me was, I'm taking you. You're coming with me. And I thought to myself, I'm not going anywhere. I don't know what's going on. And so I reached inside myself and I kind of put up a barrier. I'm staying right where I am. And it when it got to me in this instant, it reached and sort of, I guess, through I wasn't in this darkness. I was on the edge of this darkness. And I don't know what was behind me, but it reached into this place where I was and took me. And I had no way of stopping it. And when it took me, it enveloped me and surrounded me and carried me. And so I was inside of this intelligence and it was showing me its intelligence. It was and its intelligence was a 100,000 times order higher than mine. It was so much smarter than me and so much more powerful than me. It was also showing me its might, but not in an angry way, but just in its like all powerful, you're coming with me and there's nothing you can do about it. And I was inside of it and it was feeding me comfort, feeding me, it's showing me its power, showing me its intellect, giving me comfort. And I'd been out of my body before as a child, but this time that silver cord, the cord that connects to the, it was severed, it was gone. And now I was completely disconnected from that life. And I was being carried back up the same trajectory that it had come down, elevator shaft, tunnel, whatever you want to call it. But I was in the middle of this vast darkness being carried up very rapidly. And I had a physical body, but it wasn't human. I had a shape and I call it my light body. It was like I was made up of all these photons from the electromagnetic spectrum, all these different photons, but it was sort of still shaped like a human being. And I was, you know, the image of the dead person with the halo on the cloud looking down, I was sort of like sitting on a cloud inside of this cloud, inside of this intelligence, this orb. But it was as comfortable as sitting on a feather bed. Let me change that to a really nice foam mattress. It was as comfortable as that, but I couldn't move. And I was inside of this intelligence that was carrying me up, and it was transparent. So I could see out of it and I could see my own physical form. And I was superposition. I had another self that was a God point of view outside of this angelic form, wherein I could see myself inside the angelic being being carried. But when I was in the self inside the angelic being, when I looked, I couldn't see the eye that I was seeing myself with. So I had this, I had this dual experience as I was being carried up. And I got carried up to this edge where this space of darkness ended, and then this angelic being, either this intelligence, either unfolded and I kind of popped out of it, or it unfolded and became this space. I can't see this part of my NDE. I don't know exactly what happened, but I found myself inside this womb, and this womb was not eternal in size, but larger, as large as our universe, empty of material. So there's no star, there are no planets. It's just this huge bubble of darkness. And I'm in the middle of it. And I am now an orb of consciousness. I am a big, huge energy ball, 10,000 times bigger than my human beingness. And I knew myself. As soon as I was in this space, I know that this is me, and this has always been me, and that my human form had never really been me. It had been my temporary form, but this much larger being is who I was. And my thinking, I had no brain, and I was in a place of nothingness. So there's no thing here. I talk about it in metaphor, and I use photon or molecule or, you know, any of these words, but there's no thing there at all. There's nothing there that's anything like here. And I had consciousness. My orb self was my consciousness, but it was also my seeing and my hearing and my understanding. I was one entity, and I was comfortable. I was safe. I was home. And I could see in 10,000 directions at once. I could see this dark edge. And at this dark edge at the far distant edge of this womb that I was inside of, that I couldn't see inside of. And as I looked at this and felt this comfort, the darkness, and it was an illuminated darkness because I could see inside of it. It's completely dark and there's nothing there and it's all timelessness. And yet I can see inside of it with my 10,000 eyes. And then it rips open and like a door opens, or a waterfall of light comes. The door opens and there's light, or there's this waterfall, however want to think about it. And as I see this light is coming from the deep darkness and showing itself to me with this seductive, luscious, beautiful invitation of attraction, the most desirous I'd ever seen. And I want it, and it wants me. And it is simultaneously a flow of white light and all of the electromagnetic spectrum at the same time. So it looks to me, and it's not flipping from A to B, A to B, A to B. It's more like A and B at the same time. And it's all pure white, uncreated light. And it's made up of a billion septillion individual colors of light. And not just like blues and greens, visible light, but x-rays and ultraviolets and infrareds and other spectrum beyond that I can tell you. So it's the full electromagnetic spectrum and way beyond that. And it's all these particles of light. And it's solid one and many at the same time. And so beautiful. And as I think, I want this, I rush it. My thinking is my movement. I want it. I move toward it. And as I move toward it, it moves toward me. And it's gigantic. It's so much bigger than me. And I get right up next to it. And it's got this solid surface that's these, you know, all these different colors and this one color. And so it's solid, and yet it's also translucent. I can see into it all of these colors in this light, and then it's transparent. I can see to the darkness on the other side of it, and I want it. And so I touch it with my being, and as I touch it with my being, I open. And as I open, it inflows inside of me and envelops me. And then all these things happen at the same time. I hear my original self being made and called into being, not like at a point in time, but like all the time. Like it's being called into being right in the moment where I am, and had been called into being eons and eons before in the same way, because this is timelessness. So I had this experience of being ancient, not ancient in a human sense, but ancient, like I can't even explain it. I can't. And I knew that I was created, and not just my human self was created, but this aspect of me that was individuated from the fullness of the divine had a moment of creation when I separated from the fullness of the divine and became this higher consciousness self. So while that's going on and I'm hearing my original name being called and I'm being called into being, I see my human self and I see my human self. I experience my human self. I can see my body. I'm outside of it and I'm inside of it. And there's this I, and this I is looking into my human self and it sees everything about me, everything that I had been in my life, and that there are no hidden places. Even the things that I had done when I was young that I hid from myself, you know, I did this bad thing, whatever it was. I stole somebody's bubble gum when in third grade or whatever it was. Not that I did that, but I could have. That which I hid from myself was visible to me. Those things that I hid from other people, my shadow parts, those were visible to me. And it wasn't just observational in my life review. I experienced all of the pain that I gave away in my life as I was the other person who I gave it to. And so I was karmically, all the pain I gave away was mine. It accrued to me. And the divine, meanwhile, was saying to me, non-linguistically, I love you. I've been with you. I was with you in every experience, and I loved you every moment of your existence, no matter. I loved the shadow sides of you too. I love the whole of you. I love you unconditionally. And so I experienced all of this pain that I gave away. I experienced my reasons for giving it away. And I experienced this love that was being shown to me and given to me as a gift, and that I had always been loved. And when I accepted this love, when the love that had also been given to me in my life and the love that I had given away, when that became apparent, I surrendered myself. And when I surrendered myself, my attachment to my wrongdoing, when I accepted the love and forgiveness, I was infilled with the love and forgiveness. And I want to say I wasn't judged. This divine, the divine being, who had no gender, had no religion, had no nothing. There was no thing about it that was at all conceivable by humanity, by my own human mind. Now, I can't grasp it. It was so far beyond. But the love was so immense that love had always been there for me. I had always been forgiven. It had always been merciful to me. I was the one who was causing my own suffering. I was the one who judged myself. It never judged me. It accepted me as I was. So then I inflated like a balloon, bigger and bigger. And as more of this light poured inside of me and expanded me. And it wasn't just light. It was love, beauty, truth, joy, understanding, knowledge, bliss, paradise, peace, awe, adoration, all these different things that we subdivide in earth as we talk about them. It was a oneness of being that filled me. And it was glory and magnificence and majesty. And as I expanded, I reached a point at which I had this almost painful knowledge that one more drop of it and I would enfold back into it. It wasn't pain like bad pain. It was more like pain like right on the edge of like orgasm pain, where it's like almost, and you're like, oh my God, I'm, and it's like, and then I reduced. And as I should add one more thing, is that in this state, I saw my original self. And as I saw my original self, I was a singular photon superpositioned with this field of light. Remember the field of light that I was seeing, all these different electromagnetic colors. And it was infinitely deep and infinitely high and infinitely wide. And I was one of them, one of those lights, but I was also separate from it. I was outside of it, called into beingness. My beingness, my original self, my true self is this speck. And in this speck, I could then see another level of myself. And this other level of myself was myself that gets incarnated. So I was like this other part of me. I could see this long tail of my created soul. So I had this super higher self, and then I had this higher lower self, of my created soul that entered into lives, and I could see all these other lives that physical lives that I had lived, and many of them were human, but not all of them were human, and there was a chronology to them, but from my point of view, they were all simultaneous. Because at the chronology, at the far end of it was the life I had just lived, but they were all happening at the same time. And I asked to look inside, and I stepped into two different lives, one a human life, one not a human life. I understood that not my human lives, my physical lives, and even this incarnating soul life, that's not me. I am this other, I am this golden fleck of a photon. And I wanted knowledge. I wanted to understand how our universe worked. In an instant, I saw all of it. Someone said to me in his experience just the other day, he was talking about how he saw mathematical equations astrophysicists use. It was sort of like that. I saw all of the structures that create everything that there is and the whole kit and caboodle. And I can't grasp it now. My brain is way too small. So all these things all happen at the same time. And then I'm reduced back down again. I have some reconnection to my life I had just lived. And I said, am I dead? And the voice said, this voice that it was the entire dark space I was inside of. And it was also inside of me, but there was no, like, you know, white man with a long white beard on a throne thing. It was this way beyond that. And it spoke to me and said, yes, you're dead. Not language, but yes, you're dead. And I said, well, I can't stay here. And it swept me across this womb to the edge of a field where our universe began. And so part of me poked out into the universe, and I could see all of our universe like that. There's a new telescope vision of all these galaxies and how they are connected in these vast spaces between them. And it's like that. And I can see millions and millions of galaxies and the vast spaces between them. And my vision was aimed back to the origin of our universe. And I could see the origin of it in the now. So it's, I don't know how to explain this. It was time and timelessness. So the darkness that I could see the edge of this darkness that was the uncreated divine being that I, even in this higher state, I couldn't comprehend. But out of this darkness poured this light, and this light became a web that formed underneath our universe. And so this light was became the matter itself, and then formed into the universe and was inside of everything that I could see, everything. And as this weaving was going on, as this our universe was being continually created, all these other universes were popping out of this light. It was universe after universe after universe after universe, boom, 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 boom. And I couldn't see inside of them, but I could see inside of this one. And I could see that they're being made in the same way. And as I'm watching this, the divine says to me from the darkness and the light that's woven into the universe and the womb of which I'm still inside, this resonant love that is all that there is, that is this infinite love that I that drives my life now. It was aimed at me, as I was the most beloved that there of all. And as I'm experiencing the all is well, all has been well, all will be well, I have loved you forever and ever with this immense love, as I'm experiencing this with this particularity of my specialness, my vision is shifted to Earth, and I can see Earth in live time, and like a hologram, 7 billion people. And inside of every single person is this golden fleck of divine light. And the love that I'm experiencing, it's particular and unique to me, is the exact, paradoxically, exactly the same as everyone else. And so I am the most beloved, but so is everybody else. Everybody's beloved. And I can see all the people on Earth, and it's live. It's like half the Earth is in darkness and half of it's in daylight. And people are doing things. There's a ship at sea. There's, you know, wars going on. There's babies being born. I can see all of it all at once. And inside of every single human being is this divine light. And nobody on Earth can see it like I can see it, because there's like this fog around the planet, and nobody can perceive it as I can. And I can see what I see in this light is the fullness of the love of the divine, like in that I'm experiencing in my disembodied state, in my heavenly self. And then my parents' faces rise up from earth and I see my mom and my dad, A, and my mom and my dad, B, and there's two lives for them, you know, mom's life and dad's life and mom's life and dad's life. And in A, they don't have me. I don't go back and I see the immensity of their suffering. I see the destruction of my parents. And then in B, I see them with me and I see suffering, but less suffering. But then I see their deaths. I don't see exactly how they die, but I see that at the moment of their death, and I understand because it's told to me that they will be with me in a flash of time because life is not, because time is this long in heaven. It's nothing. And that if I just wait and stay, because I'm being welcomed and healed and whole. I didn't mention those words, but healed and whole and no more suffering. If I just wait, they'll be with me in a moment and their suffering will be over, either A or B. And I had this flash of compassion and I said, well, you know, I'm in timelessness and life is short and time doesn't, you know, time is immaterial to me. Do I have to stay here? Can I go back? And the voice said, well, it's time for you to come home, but yeah, you can go back. And I say, well, then I choose to live my life if I can come back here. And the voice says, yes, you can come back here, but you won't live your life, and shot me out. And as I got shot out, I got compressed again. So I lost this highest self. And even the next life down, the next level down, I became very rapidly this light body again, encased in the same angelic being, which, by the way, was also superpositioned. It was also divine itself. It was God itself in a more limited form for me, but it was both. And so I'm being carried out from heaven and far away. And I can see this beam of light coming out of this darkness, like a big, huge laser beam. And right in front of me, it stops at all these doors. And there's all these doors, a million doors. And in the middle of all these million doors is this big, huge beam of light, bigger than all the doors, and radiating out within a decreasing fashion to the outer edge from decreasing intensity. And the voice, which is still, I'm still being carried by the divine, this angelic being, says to me, choose light. And I had to choose a door. And so and what it meant by choose, it meant choose your life, choose elements of what you want. And I knew in this state that I had a calling, I had a message, I was on a mission, and I understood, or at least I thought, I had been working in construction all the way through college, swinging a hammer, running a jackhammer. I was going to be an architect. And so I'm working in the trades to get familiar and earn a living, pay for school. And I thought, all these blue collar guys I was working with, if I go back and I'm this highfalutin person, they'll never talk to me. If I'm going back to try to help people, I've got to be fully human. And so I ask for fully humanness, and I want to be kind of a writer, and I have all these other little thoughts too. And I want the light. So I don't choose the big beam of light. I choose off to the side, not terribly far away, still in the light, but definitely not in the purity of it. And then as soon as I make this choice, the door opens and I'm being carried down. And in this tunnel, there are 10,000 doors. And all of these doors are choices that lead to all these other tunnels, millions of tunnels. And I get carried down this one tunnel, past all these doors, to the end. And when I get to the end, the door opens and there's a body on a cliff and somebody bent over, and I can see, and I'm just totally dispassionate about it. I'm like, oh, look at that. That's an interesting sight. And then the angelic being pierces the chest and stuffs me inside. And I've been way reduced in size, compacted. And now I'm inside this form, and I can still see out through this heart opening this divine angelic being and back toward the darkness, and then it just closes. And as it closes, I'm immensely immediately put into suffering. Like, everything hurts. My brain starts to whir back on and I'm in pain, and I begin to hear sound, and it resolves into screaming and yelling. And I open my eyes and it's Tim, and he's shaking me. Don't die. Don't die. Don't die. Don't die. And then he's like, you're awake. You're alive. You're awake. I thought you were dead. And he pulls me up, and the rope came free and we descended, and I became an entirely different person from that moment on, and have been ever since.
Not many people make the choice to come back.
No, most people don't have a choice. Most people get sent back, from what I understand. Well, I died again in 2015 of a heart problem. I had a 100% blockage in my widowmaker, and I chose to come back again for my granddaughter this time. But I can see the temporality. I can see the temporality of my life, which gives me the desire to go home, but also gives me the strength to be here.
Yeah. How was it integrating that incredible experience with the lower density here on Earth? I mean, the juxtaposition of the pure bliss to the game we're playing in this reality system is so different. How did you...
Not well.
How did you navigate that? And how you probably are still doing it today.
I am still doing it today. And back in 1980, there was no internet, and I had no name for near-death experience. I didn't know what had happened to me. All I knew is that this thing had happened to me. But I'd been fortunate. I went to a Catholic, private Catholic school, all-guys school, where I learned centering prayer meditation, and I was already a practitioner. And so my original way of integrating was through meditation, and it is through meditation still, because when I came back into this horrid, jagged, broken, fragile, thin, weak, violent, destructive world of blind people, nobody could see what I could see, and the whole thing hurt. The only place I found solace was inside myself. And so I was fortunate. I was in a theater troupe from Montana State. We went on this 3-month theater tour almost immediately after my NDE. And instead of riding in the van for 24,000 miles, I isolated and sat in the back of the pickup truck by myself and meditated most of the time I was back there, just to try to find some stability. I found Kriya Yoga through Paramahansa Yogananda and the Yoga Sutras. And I began a practice with Hatha Yoga. Then I decided that I needed to study more to understand what had happened to me, to see, because it was really different. I was an entirely different person. Everything was, I couldn't relate to anything anymore. I didn't believe in anything human constructed, nothing. I had no belief system at all in anything we thought of. Even language became an effort for me to have to construct concepts to speak in words which never are accurate. So everything was broken for me. And so I went into divinity school, and I ended up working in Christianity as a mechanism for me to hide my radical spirituality, because I didn't tell anybody what happened to me. And I continued my intellectual studies, but mostly I continued my interior practice. And what I found is that all the head knowledge that I accrued has been helpful to me, but really the thing that matters the most for me is my interior journey, because the more I surrender my attachment to my egoic self breath by breath, the more I backfoot myself in heaven, the more easy it is to integrate into this lower level. I found it to be depressing here. I went through a very long period of depression. I had suicidality. I was isolated and alone. I couldn't talk about it because I didn't know how to talk about it, but also because I was afraid people were going to think I was crazy.
Which they would have.
Which they would have. And I had an experience where that happened. I masked and dove deep inside.
Yeah. How were you able to reconstitute the relationships that you had once you came back and everything was different? I imagine your perceptions of all the systems and structures and the goofy things we do on this planet was, you must have been looking at it like you were watching a circus almost.
Oh yeah, exactly like that. And not a good circus either.
Yeah.
So I went on this theater tour, and I'd been in rehearsal with this troupe since September. And I came back so radically different. I didn't know how to integrate with them. I couldn't relate to them. And so I isolated. That's how I did it. I self-isolated and I minimalized my human interactions. But what really helped me is that there were two women in this theater group, Carrie and Randa, and we were friends, completely platonic. But for some reason, they loved me and I loved them. And it was through their acceptance of my silence that allowed me to slowly work my way back into human relationship. And when I got back home to that summer, I hitchhiked back from, long story, I had to hitchhike back to Boston. So I hitchhiked back to Boston. And that summer, my parents, and I asked my parents about this 20 years later, 30 years later, what was different about me? And my mom and my dad both looked at each other and said, you were very different. You were compassionate. You were just doing stuff. We didn't have to ask you to do the dishes. We didn't have to ask you to sweep the floor. We didn't have to ask you to do anything anymore. You just did it. And you never were like that before. You were a good kid, but you just never did that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we wondered what had happened to you. I saw every human being as light. I saw every tree as light, every flower as light, but human beings in particular had a radiance inside them. And I had this like broad beam of love for everyone. And even compassion for the brokenness, because I saw my own brokenness when I was dead. I recognized the brokenness of others and lost my judgment of them for that. And so my behavior was misinterpreted fairly often.
Yeah. You know, that's what I worry about, the brokenness on the planet. And as we move forward and things get a little goofier, you know, I worry about the brokenness and the human ability to connect with the divine. How do you see that? And how do you see people with experiences like yours? I realize it's a very impactful experience for the experiencer. But I also look at it as we are hearing about it and seeing it so much more because these are breadcrumbs for humanity. These are clues. And the fact that you have come back, you chose to come back and articulate it so beautifully and really bring us there, that's a clue. That's a clue for us to start paying attention that there's another side to this reality system. How do you see I would imagine that you feel like you have a very, very strong mission and you're clearly not done because you're still here. How do you see that now? And how do you see humanity and not be terribly concerned?
Well, because of my biblical studies, I identified with Jonah, the reluctant prophet. He's like, he didn't want the job. I didn't want the job. I resisted the job. I didn't want it. I know that I had agreed to it, but when I got back here, I was like, I do not want to do this thing. Let me do anything other than this thing, or let me come home. One of the two. But I couldn't get out of the grip. And so I have a mission and I'm driven. And from the moment I came back, every job I've ever had ever since, almost every decision I've ever made comes from this higher place of myself. Doesn't mean I always make the right choice though. Okay. Don't think I'm, always Mr. Goody Goody because I'm not. I make bad choices too. But in terms of humanity, back in the 1960s, cardiac care came online and they started resuscitating people in ORs. And that technology has grown since the 1960s and spread all over the world. And now there's tens of millions of people who have come back. I just read a paper this week by Dr. Sam Parnia in his AWARE studies, and it was just published in October of this year. And one of the things I learned in it is out of the 547 people in their study, 360 or something like that, they were able to study. And out of that 360, something like 10% survived cardiac death. So it's a very small percentage of people who actually survive with cardiac care. But there's like 10 to 20 million of us in the United States, and all over the world is 10 to 20 million, in every country. So there's this huge explosion of, well, it's like the Tower of Babel. We've built a machine to reach heaven, and the machine is cardiac care, and people are coming back.
and they're touching the divine and then coming back here and telling us about it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so now it's always been near-death experience in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. There's stories here and there, but now there's so many of us, so many of us. Yeah. And every one of us is like a little, has a fiber optic cable at the end of which is a diode. And this diode is illuminated right where we are. And so we're all coming back with our individual experiences because the divine is compassion itself and gives us what we need. And according to what the individual is, and we're coming back as like little bubbles with little bubbles of light, which enhances the whole planet. And we're in this terrible time in the history of humanity. Humanity is 300,000. Homo sapiens are estimated to be 300,000 years old. And
here a long, long time.
We have
fallen and risen and fallen and risen. And
here we are again, but we haven't changed a whole heck of a lot. Yeah. Our tribalism has been the function of our survival and our animosity. It has both of these things. And now we've filled the planet. There's like 8 billion of us. We're shoulder to shoulder, essentially. We've got climate changes. We just had basically a hurricane where I live today in December, or January rather. And the world is in turmoil politically and economically and wars. And it's a pretty hard time we're in right now. But here's the thing. Never in the history of the world has been so many people who have been accidentally enlightened.
Yeah.
And so I think we have an opportunity to nudge the planet to a new way of self-understanding. And simultaneous with that is the light has this amplification to it. So Jesus in the Gospels, the canonical Gospels, says where two or more are there, I am there. So there's this third presence. And this third presence is this amplification, this multiplication that happens where people who've experienced the light, when they gather, it's bigger and bigger and bigger. And so there is this resonance that's happening. There's this a new way of thinking that's happening. So I'm hopeful. We might go through a pretty hard time coming up, but humanity is pretty resourceful and flexible over the history of our time on the planet. I think we have a chance to become something better and bigger than we've ever been. All that said, we're just a blip. I saw in one of my experiences, I saw the nature of myself in comparison with 13.7 billion light years of existence of the universe. I am nothing in this. I'm nothing in this timeline. Nothing. I'm compared to everything else. I'm nothing. And that humanity, as self-important as we think we are, we're not. And by stepping aside from our self-importance is actually the surrender we need in order to be in the light. When we stop thinking we're the best there is, individually and collectively, then I really think we have a chance to have a better and brighter human future.
Did you come back with any special skills or expanded awareness? In other words, are you able to perceive things that you didn't prior to your experience? Any telepathy or connection with spirit?
Oh, lots of things. I didn't make it my pursuit. Some people make it their pursuit. I made the pursuit of oneness of being my pursuit because that's what I saw. That's what I am. But ghost experiences. I read people like I hear things inside my head that people are thinking and I say it out loud and I don't know that I'm hearing that this is. So it's not like I'm listening in and I'm like repeating. It's like suddenly I'm talking about things that they were just speaking about. That happens all the time. So, you know, something random like quartz crystal. And I wouldn't have talked about quartz crystals in like 5 years. And then in this one conversation, I'd be talking about it and the person would be like, I was just thinking that. I have electromagnetic problems in my life. But mostly my after gifts are the perception of the divine inside of everything there is. I live inside a bubble of heaven now. And so even though I might have a bad day, something might happen and I'm sad or angry, I can't not see the light no matter what happens. It's around me and informs my being and informs everything I do and am. So for me, the best after gift I have besides compassion and kindness is just being in the light itself.
Yeah.
And that is my guide interiorly and exteriorly.
And holding that space here.
Yes.
You've
written
a book.
For my own survival.
And it does the rest of us good as well. You've written a book, Heaven is Beautiful. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Sure. It's an Audible international bestseller, which I'm very surprised and pleased about. And it's been optioned for a film. And I'm finishing my responsibilities this week, 3-year responsibilities contractual with this production, these two producers to provide additional material. And I will finish it this week after 3 years of work. And then it's movie making time.
Oh, that's exciting.
By the time I wrote the book, I had already come out of the NDE closet in my community, in my state. I wasn't working in television at the time. And so people around my state knew that this had happened to me because it was on TV. And so telling my story was a little nerve-wracking because I was afraid that I might lose respect or my credibility as a capable professional person. But mostly I was afraid that my writing was going to be bad. I was like, I really want my writing to be good because all I want to be is a writer. And so it turned out pretty good with lots of help. I definitely didn't do it alone.
So are you afraid of dying?
Not a moment, not a single moment since the day it happened. And I guess that's a pretty big after effect because, so when I died again in 2015, I was happy. And so my wife's there, my son's there. I'm trying to keep my chill and my, you know, my joy kind of like I'm going home today. So that, cause I could tell that they weren't seeing it that way. But
and
no,
your wife was probably saying, no, you're not.
No, actually. She understood that the first chance I was going to get, I was going to go. We had that. My kids weren't prepared for that. And I came back for my granddaughter because she needed me, but I'm not afraid of dying. I mean, I'm not afraid of death. Dying can be hard. I've seen a lot of death in my life. I was a minister. And so I was around a lot of dying people and it can be hard. Dying can be very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to die a hard death, but if I do, it'll be okay because I'm going to get out of here in the end. In the end, it's going to end and I'm going to go back home and it's going to be so much better. It's so much better on the other side.
Wonderful. So how do we find out more about you?
I'm at peterpanagore.love, peterpanagore.love. Mm-hmm. And I have a YouTube channel, Peter Panagore, where I do a deconstruction of Christian theology and biblical studies from a point of view of near-death experience. And right now I'm working on the four major branches of yoga and the comparison to Christian tradition. And I teach meditation and I teach Kriya yoga. I have a private Kriya yoga group and it works. So I'm at peterpanagore.love. Check me out. I do counseling. I help people integrate from their mystical experiences. I did one counseling session this morning with a fella from a corporation, people from all different walks of life. About 3 weeks ago, it was a high-level diplomat. And a week before that, it was a clerk at a convenience store. Anybody can have these kind of experiences, near-death experience or a mystical experience. And because my whole life has been about trying to figure out how to integrate, I can help you do that too.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kimberly.
Thank you for joining us on the Journey to the New Earth podcast. We hope we've created a safe space for our listeners to find out more. Whether you're curious or have a deeper reason for joining our community, please share our podcast on your socials, and with a simple click to subscribe, we'll invite you back to our next episode. Remember, we're all in this journey to the New Earth, so let's enjoy the ride.